Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Ari Shavit, who is a leading Israeli journalist, a columnist for Haaretz, and a commentator on Israeli public television. His new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Shavit.
Pleasure to be here.
And we're speaking at the very moment when Secretary of State Kerry is arriving in Israel. His aide, General Allen, has been there for some time working on the deal. We may have something of a paradox here in American politics where the current Secretary of State is on a roll. He's getting things done, and his predecessor is going to run for president. Go figure. But, you know, we know there's a peace process and there's no peace. Can that be broken, that lie?
You hit it right on the nail. My concern, look, I'm a great admirer of Secretary Kerry's determination and moral commitment. I think that he's absolutely right in realizing that the two-state solution is slipping away and that action must be taken immediately. And I admire the risks he's taking, the resources he's putting in. He's a real, I don't know him personally, but from all I see, he's a real noble person trying to lead a noble initiative. And yet, I'm worried. And I'll tell you what my worry is. I think that the chances of striking a final status agreement, a real peace, within a few months, as the Secretary is committed to do, this is, in my mind, highly unlikely. I hope to be proven wrong. I'll be the first one to rejoice if the Secretary succeeds. But I dread the implications of failure. We've seen the implications of failure in 2000 when President Clinton did it, the same thing. He was very noble. He spent amazing resources. He became a master of all the details of the conflict. He took the parties to Camp David. He took an amazing risk. And the consequence was not peace, but terrible war. So I think that we have to learn from history. And my advice and wish is to prepare a plan B. Because if, God forbid, Secretary Kerry fails, and in a few months' time, by spring or early summer, this initiative will collapse, the results, I don't think we'll go back to war immediately, but I think we will see a terrible political crisis, and the result will be that Israelis will feel betrayed, Palestinians will feel betrayed, and the American Secretary of State will feel betrayed, and therefore he himself and the next secretary will not want to touch this. So my wish is let's plan a plan B. So in case this doesn't work, there is a fallback option, because otherwise the consequences might be dramatic.
So what do you make then of the EU pressuring the Palestinian Authority, threatening to cut off aid? Now, we know that the United Nations is having problems meeting its bills for the Palestinian camps, which have been going on forever and have created this culture of dependency. But because of what's happening in Syria with the massive humanitarian crisis where a third of the population is displaced, the money's being squeezed both at the EU and at the UN. So what's the point of putting pressure on the Palestinians? That's almost to suggest that they're certainly a part of the problem, but are they the problem?
Well, I think I understand the ones who are trying to deal with all parties with a kind of carrot and sticks approach. And I think probably this is why the Secretary and the Europeans believe that perhaps they have a chance right now because they have bigger sticks and bigger and sweeter carrots, and they're trying to play with that. That's legitimate, you know, that's part of diplomacy. Diplomacy in the Middle East cannot be naive. It must be assertive diplomacy. If you want, when President Carter reached the peace agreement, the historic peace agreement in 78 and 79 between Israel and Egypt, it wasn't easy. It wasn't, there are no flower children in the Middle East. Not Israelis, not Palestinians. You're dealing with rough players, cunning players. You have to be sophisticated and realistic in dealing with them. So I don't mind some pressure being put. But my concern, again, is that that will be within the context of something that is workable. And my great concern is that the Palestinians right now are too, even if they want to strike the grand deal, and I have some doubts, but assume they want to, they have real difficulty. They are too weak now with the Arab Spring and the Arab chaos that followed. Any moderate Palestinian leader, by the way, any moderate Arab leader, lacks the legitimacy needed to strike the grand deal, to make the real compromises on Jerusalem and the right of return. The last person who really had that authority was, ironically, Yasser Arafat. But it didn't work out with him. I don't know if he wanted it, but he was the Palestinian revolution. He could have made the historical compromise. I doubt it if Mahmoud Abbas and the others, they're just too weak. They're moderate people. I doubt. Now, the same applies to the Israelis.
By the way, if they're also divided. They're divided, too.
Yeah, of course. It's complicated in everywhere. But the same applies on the Israeli side. I doubt it whether Prime Minister Netanyahu and the government are willing to go for the grand deal. But say they are willing, right now the political circumstances are such that it will be very difficult for them. So let's plan a plan B, something more moderate, more gradual, that can be applied and move us in the right direction towards a two-state, what I call two-state state, rather than a two-state solution, that will improve the conditions on the ground and enable us to reach the grand deal later on. But again, I'd be very happy to be proven wrong, and I'll be the first one to congratulate the Secretary if he proves me wrong.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Shavit, who is a leading Israeli journalist, a columnist at Haaretz, and a commentator on Israeli public television. His new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. And this book, by the way, has gotten some of the most amazing reviews. They're like Valentines, for God's sake. But the New York Times described it as the book ultimately becomes a book of lamentation, a moral cri de coeur. So tell us about then the inherent duality that you bring out in the book between occupation and intimidation, the point being that Israel is unique in as much as it has existential threats surrounding it. At the same time, it's created this condition of occupation and colonialism that's eating at its moral heart.
I thank you for the question, but let me refer first of all for the reviews. Really, I'm so blessed for the way the book was received so far. I'm so thankful to all these great people. But I think that although I love my book and I hope I have something to contribute, I think it shows that there was a wish, there was a thirst, a hunger to hear some new kind of voice coming out of Israel. And I think that the way the book was embraced so far shows that it answers a certain deep need in this country. You know, people told me years ago while I was writing it, you know, no one will be interested. You know, Israel is off the map. So people are so tired. Yes, people are tired of the old conversation about Israel. And I think what the book offers, and I try to offer myself, is a new kind of conversation, which leads me exactly to your point. My claim is that anyone dealing with a conflict there who has a simplistic idea is wrong. The reality is very complex. So first of all, if you come with a simplistic idea, you are wrong. If we all agree that it's so complex and try to deal and wrestle with the complexity, then we begin the real deal and dealing with the real issues. And the basic complexity is exactly the one you mentioned, which is that on the one hand, it's unbearable, and I find it outrageous, that Israel is an occupying power. It is the only Western country, the democracy, that occupies another people. This is unbearable. This is wrong. On the other hand, one has to remember that Israel is the only nation on the face of this earth that is existentially intimidated. The danger to its existence is real. What we see generally is the people on the left, for good moral reasons, focus on occupation and tend to ignore intimidation, while the people on the right focus on intimidation and ignore occupation. I ask us all to unite around the whole thing. If we really see the two pillars of the issue, then we can deal with the issues seriously. And in my mind, if the world and the Israeli left and all the international peace movements will acknowledge the seriousness of intimidation, the fact that Israelis really have legitimate fears, that are not just psychological, then we can actually deal with occupation. Because so far what has happened, because we offered the Israeli people only an all-or-nothing deal, and because we did not address their fears and their concerns, and we did not really deal with the intimidation seriously, they rejected all peace offers because they seemed to them unreal. If we come up with a plan that is realistic, that goes for a kind of new peace concept, that addresses the real threats to Israel, then I think we can actually convince the Israeli center, at least, and begin a real process that would end occupation.
But there is this other component, which we started out talking about, which is why the secretary is there. The U.S. is what? The referee, the sponsor, the ally. And I think one of the reasons why your book is being so well received is that American Jews, I think, 75% of whom are on the liberal side, I think are increasingly uncomfortable with the representation through AIPAC of only the right wing in Israel. And you've got these young journalists like Max Blumenthal writing books that basically are because he's offended as an American Jew having to take on all this baggage.
I see the issue and I see the challenge. I mean, the problem we've had in the last decades is that we've seen a growing, intensifying alliance between Tea Party America and Tea Party Israel. And what I come to say is, let's do exactly the opposite. Let's recreate and redefine and revive the alliance between non-Tea Party America and non-Tea Party Israel. I think this is needed. Definitely it's needed for progressive American Jewry, but it's needed for progressive America, not only the Jews, and it's definitely needed for the progressive Israelis, because only if we work together, again, with realistic ideas, but we really have shared values. We really do not want occupation. We really do not want an Israel that is ultra-religious and fundamentalist in some ways. I think Israel is not there. I think the battle is not lost. I think that this darker picture of Israel that we've seen in recent years, there are problems there, but the battle has not been lost. And therefore, if we work together, I think we can actually revive peace, when we revive the possibility of having a benign Israel that progressive Americans, Jewish or not Jewish, can be proud of and can actually celebrate rather than reject.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Shavit, who is a leading journalist, a columnist for Haaretz, a commentator on Israeli public television, and his new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. Now, in terms of the book, you talk about its settlement, and of course your great-grandfather was a British Zionist, and you say here, because obviously it started out as a sort of socialist experiment and is now largely dominated by the right, because former President Bill Clinton put his foot in his mouth by suggesting that Israel was inexorably moving to the right because of the influx of Russians, and that caused quite a stir, but clearly its politics have moved to the right. But you say all this idealistic socialism is just subterfuge, future critics will claim. It is the moral camouflage of an aggressive nationalist movement whose purpose is to obscure its colonialist expansionist nature. That's a tough...
That's not you.
That's Dwight Garner in the New York Times. I see. Sorry. He put it in quotes, so I thought he was quoting you.
I'll deal with the issue.
Right.
I'll tell you what I do. I do believe Israel, and I think this is part of the complexity that has to be resolved. Israel, in the beginning, was idealized, and the idea was really that it will be this kind of utopia. So you had the socialist dreams, and you had the kibbutz, and people were not satisfied just with the idea of saving the Jews and giving the Jews a home, giving a homeless people a home at last. They thought it must be the perfect home; it must be paradise of absolute morality and justice. And many Jews and Zionists worked within that framework. That is gone. Israel is not a utopia, and it will not be utopia. The kibbutz will not be back, and these great dreams that I have, I love those dreams, but that will not happen. And yet, that does not mean that Israel is evil. And because that's the other side, people had had such high expectations and wanted so much of it and held it for such high standards that when that did not happen, they moved to the other extreme. That's not fair. The Jews, the Jewish people, and the Jews who went to Palestine and turned it into Israel have a right for a home like any other nation. In some senses, more than any other, some nation, because they are the ultimate victims of the 20th century. They are the ultimate victims of Europe. To say about them that they are colonizers or evil is, in my mind, absolutely ridiculous, although they've done many, there were many wrongdoings. So let's get it right. What you do see in Israel today, and that's the good news, is you see a very free, robust society that is life-loving, innovative, creative. So let's connect to that, to the positive forces in Israel that are amazing, not only in high tech, which is talked about, but in any fields of life, in arts, in culture, in literature, in dance, what you name it. There are so many Israel who have such amazing vitality while living in this dangerous situation. Let's connect to them, relate to them, and bring these forces into the political so we solve the unbearable political problems of occupations and the other ones. So don't – I find that people who moved from admiring Israel to hating Israel, I ask them to grow up and have be much more fair in their – an attitude to that country. Yes, criticize what must be criticized. Denounce the wrongdoing that you see. But at the same time, appreciate what is a remarkable human endeavor, because at the end of the day, these are victims and survivors and homeless people who build a home for themselves. And that has to be appreciated.
Well, indeed, I think, to be fair, the problems that you also point out about modern Israel, along with what you just said in terms of praising the achievements we share here in the United States, the growing disparity in wealth, a restless young who don't see the same opportunities that their parents had. You've had those massive demonstrations by the young. You know, it seems to me that these two countries, in terms of their real challenges, are absolutely entwined.
Absolutely. Let me tell you something. Two things that I have on my mind as you speak. One, in the past, we used to say in Israel, when we were so critical of our political system, you would say, why cannot we be like Americans? Well, what happened is that rather than we become like Americans, Americans became like Israelis, and your system is now so polarized and difficult that I wish, as someone who loves America and thinks we need a strong and benign in America, I wish that you'll get your problems sorted out. But the other element is that in Israel is that we went through this Americanization process, so to speak. As you said, we left behind our social democracy. We moved to capitalism in a rather brutal kind of capitalism. As a result is extreme inequality. So on the one hand, you have a very vital, impressive economy that is growing, low unemployment, high growth, quite a tiger, Israel is. On the other hand, the price is real inequality. In the 50s, we were so fragile and poor, there was much more egalitarian. And now we are not, and this is something we have to address. But again, you touched the right issue. The protest, the social protest in Israel in 2011, to me, gave a lot of hope. Because after many years of despair, of the people being cynical and do not, as we did not see the vitality going into politics, what you saw in my mind is the most impressive of the world's social networks to social protest movements. The 2011 protest in Tel Aviv and then spread to the entire country, was civilized, peaceful, reasonable, not extreme. I've all the respect for the other protest movements, including the one you had here. But Israel was a phenomenal achievement in my mind of the Israeli civic society. So you saw there the potential of an Israel that, again, in a reasonable way, not in the idealistic old way, in the utopian way, but seeks social justice, seeks a lively democracy. So far, I'm disappointed by the translation of that into the political system. It did not. There were some changes, but not good enough. I hope that in the long term, that energy that we saw in 2011 that is there in the lively, young civil society in Israel will transform the system and will actually bring back that Israel we want and push back the darker forces.
Well, it's been said that if Israel and the Palestinians were ever to settle their problems, which they almost did until Rabin was shot, and people forget that Israelis were shopping in Bethlehem and gambling at casinos in Hebron, and, you know, it was a different world. It worked for a while. And Leah Rabin still blames Netanyahu for her husband's death because there was a peculiar symmetry there between Netanyahu's hawkism and the sabotage of the peace by the Iranians. So you have that kind of paradox, don't you? And I'm not suggesting that they're the same, but they have in curious ways.
First of all, I think that that criticism, I think that many mistakes were done by the Israeli right during that period, and some mistakes were done by Ms. Netanyahu, was then leader of the opposition. I think that the specific argument or claim that you just quoted is unfair. It's unfair because there were many problems throughout. And, you know, I'm a peace lover, but I'm also a Democrat. And I'm very aware to the fact that you have, when you bring about peace, you have to convince the people and you have to go through a real process where people endorse it. You cannot just impose it. Without getting into the details, at that period that you mentioned, while there was an amazing breakthrough and there was hope for a while, but I think there were flaws throughout in the system. We did not do it the right way. So, again, my lesson from that is there are two lessons. One is what I told you before. Let's bring a realistic peace process that can work. But then once we do that, let's convince the people. Let's not impose it on them. I think, look, talking of my admiration for America, when I see my progressive friends in this country, the way they went out of their convenient, their comfortable homes in nice neighborhoods to go to difficult neighborhoods in Pennsylvania or other places to try to get people to vote and to get President Obama reelected. I don't see much of that kind of activity in the Israeli center-left, in the Israeli, so to speak, peace elite. And I think it's time for us, those Israelis who want a liberal Israel, not only to count, to wait for America to impose it on Israel, not only to wait for some general who would save us from the masses. We have to go out there with a practical idea, a realistic idea, and convince the people that it's right for them. I think, by the way, this is what Rabin did. Rabin's greatest political achievement in 1992 was that he did just that. And Ehud Barak and his supporters did it for a while in 1999. But throughout, ever since then, we did not do that. So my plea is for the international community to have a realistic peace concept and for the Israeli moderates to work within the democratic system to convince the people to adopt peace, not to try to impose peace. Because if you try to impose, you get violent reactions from the other side.
But just to touch on your analogy about the Tea Party, our Tea Party, in alliance with Israel's Tea Party, what I was going to say about the idea that if there's a peace between Israel and Palestine, then the divisions in Israel then will become more prominent, the divisions between the secular and the religious. That's something I've heard for years. And the difference here is, of course, you've got Tea Party people in this country. And Mitt Romney said it in that tape that he was taped in about the 47% being freeloaders. The Tea Party believe that the rest of America are freeloaders, but the Israeli situation is the reverse. Secular Israelis subsidize the religious, do they not? And they subsidize the settlements.
Yes, although, again, it's a bit more complicated with some of the settlers whom I oppose, but are very creative people, and they work, and they have, and they are in this sense they are very, you know, productive citizens. And there is the problem that you mentioned is more relevant to the ultra orthodox world. But let me say two or three things about it. One, There I'm hopeful as well. I think that if, regarding the ultra-Orthodox, we progressive Israelis be very firm on the one hand and tell these people, we will not let you impose your values on us. We will not have you play around with segregation of women or gay rights or anything else. We'll fight you to the end on that. On the other hand, if we reach out to them as individuals, because the tendency in Israeli politics is either to surrender to the ultra-Orthodox or to hate them. I don't want to hate them. They are a minority. They have their own world. As long as they do not want to impose their values on all of us, I would like to encourage them to go out to work, to be integrated into the wider society, just like ultra-Orthodox people in Brooklyn do. So I think if we have this right approach of being very firm on the one hand, but opening our hearts to them as long as they integrate into our world rather than want to destroy our world, I think we can gradually, we will not solve this issue. There will always be tensions there, but I think that we can have a reasonable situation. And the settlers is a different issue because this is the greatest mistake Israel has done in its history. I mean, in my mind, the settlement project is the most really risks us. And in my book, I try not to do settler bashing, not to go after these people. On the contrary, I listen to them, I hear them, I have empathy to them, I try to understand their logic. But at the end of the day, I say to them and I say to you, if we will not deal with the settlement project, the settlements will kill us from within. So I hope we can find a peaceful solution there that will not be involved in civil war, God forbid, or anything like that. But this is something we must address and we must solve.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in studio, Ari Shavit, again, and leading Israeli journalist, a columnist for Haaretz, and a commentator on Israeli public television. His new book just out is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One more life.